Hello, and welcome to the Brutal Iron Gym Podcast, where our goal is to cut through the BS and deliver the brutal truth about topics related to health and happiness. Today's podcast number 1975. The topic is training, and the title is Progressive Overload for an Aging Population. One of the trainers who listens to this podcast often, and we discuss topics quite often, sent me a question, and I want to read through that, and then we'll go through the answer. So the question was, wondering if you could do a podcast about the following. I recently started training a 61-year-old man. I normally have my people follow Prolepin's chart, waving intensities, for a week mesocycle. I realize now that I probably want to explain all of that. So Prolepin's chart is a chart that is used to reference for Olympic lifting. People use it for powerlifting as well. There's debate over whether it's, you know, should be used for powerlifting, should it not be used for powerlifting. There's a lot of elements around that chart that are helpful for, like, guiding intensities, like how many reps you should do per set given what percentage of your one rep max. So if you're at, you know, 85 to 90% of your one rep max, how many reps per set should you be doing? How many total reps within a workout should you be doing? So it's a guiding chart. Now, some people will say that that is understimulating for powerlifting. That depends a lot on the accessories that you use and how strong you are. The stronger you are, the more basic heavy lifts will just annihilate you and wear you out. So people who are exceptionally strong, they might only squat once every 2 weeks because it's so heavy and so demanding on their body that that's as frequent as they can withstand that. However, you do have people who, you know, will squat 2, 3, even 4 times a week. I'm not a big fan of that because I don't feel like that's enough recovery time for connective tissues. And you're also just spending a lot of time on underloading and under intensity movement. So I'm not a big fan of squatting that often, but I have played with it before in the past with myself and with clients. Some clients like it for the confidence factor, but eventually as they get stronger, squatting is just something that does have a wear and tear amount on your body. So the more often you do that, you're actually just impairing recovery from the last time you did it, and you're limiting the ability for you to do accessories, which helped to pinpoint and isolate small weaknesses. So I've talked with people before, and there's tons of people who believe, you know, if you just want to get good at squat, bench, and deadlift, you should only squat, bench, and deadlift. I think that's very outdated, and that's been shown to not be optimal. So you do want to have some room for specific accessories in your programming. If, for example, if you're doing, say, conventional deadlift, and you have a really good blast off the floor, you can get the bar right to your knees, but then your lockout is trash. We would look at your positioning at the beginning. Maybe you have tight hamstrings. Maybe we just have bad positioning in our hips. Or maybe as you drive off the ground and the quads kind of dissipate in their ability to create more force, the glutes have to take over and maybe you just don't have glutes. So it would be helpful to do some RDL, stiff leg deadlifts, more glute isolative things to actually grow the tissue and strengthen the tissue. So Prolepin's chart is something that is a guiding parameters for programming, but I just wanted to cover that not everyone follows that and not everybody believes that you should. So he says he normally has people follow Prolepin's chart, waiving intensities for a week mesocycle. Mesocycles, and there's a lot of terms, but that just basically means for a program. So maybe he does like 4 weeks of certain lifts, then he switches to another set of lifts for 4 weeks. Maybe they'll do 8 weeks, maybe 12 weeks, whatever it might be. So the cycle is just like how long they'll stay with specific movements before they switch things up. Each mesocycle progressively increases training percentages each week, each wave. So again, this might be maybe he does a week of 80 to 85%. The next week they go to 85 to 90%. The next week 90 to 92.5%. And then the last week, if it's not a testing week, maybe they go 92 to 95. If it's a testing week, maybe they'll jump up to 100. But he's talking about basically every week they'll change the intensities that they use, which is he's using it based on percentages is how he's adjusting the intensity. Some people will adjust intensity by how many reps per set. A set of 5 reps is definitely going to be lighter than a set of 1 rep. So that's a way to modify weight load intensity. Now, a set of 5 is still very intense, but we're talking about weight load used. A set of 5 will not be able to use the same weight load as a set of 1. Now, as we go through all that, I didn't even plan to explain all that, so hopefully that made sense. He asked the question, I know I can't expect him to train at those intensities. So he's saying as a 61-year-old who is not taking TRT, now what our assumption in this question is at 61 he has less than optimal hormones. So testosterone is probably not what it was in its 20s, you know. So the hormonal profile of a 61-year-old is probably less optimal than what it would have been in their 20s and 30s, which is the age of maybe his other clients. So he's making that assumption, pretty damn safe assumption. very safe assumption. So he's saying at 61, not being in TRT, not being hormonal therapy supported, you know, it's unlikely that this person can train at those intensities. So he said, I'm assuming that recovery is trainable over time. Yes, it is. But with that being said, I'm also sure that at his age and not being on TRT, hormone therapy, his recovery threshold is much lower than my standard lifter. How do I work around this? I feel the intensity has to be there to create an adaptive response from the body. How would you structure his squats, benches, and deadlifts? So there was a lot to unpack there, more than I even anticipated when I started. So hopefully everybody followed along. Is what we're getting to is at 61 years old, what are the expected progressions that they can make? And how does he kind of control those progressions to where you can't just lift based on how the person feels, because the body is a big fat liar and the body loves doing jack shit, basically. Our body would lay on the couch all day and eat Cheetos if we'd let it. So if we go into the gym and say, well, I'm just going to lift what feels comfortable today, they're probably not going to make great progress because there's not going to be that push, like, you know, push, that progressive push to get them out of their comfort zone. But the trainer doesn't want to push them out of their comfort zone at an amount or a rate faster than what the body can actually adapt to. So given that they're likely going to have lower adaptive abilities, how do you manage that? How do you manage sets and reps per set? How do you manage weight load intensity from week to week and month to month? So I want to go through and kind of talk a little bit on the bigger scale, then we'll get down actually into the nitty-gritty of sets and reps and numbers and all these things. Now, training progressions when hormonal health is declining can be challenging because the typical responses from the body are lessened. When your hormones are within optimal ranges, or whatever the highest would have been for you as an individual, which is likely going to be in your, you know, late 20s and early 30s, you know, if we had to give a big fat range, I'd say somewhere between 22 to say 35, maybe 40. That's kind of be like the sweet spot of hormonal health, and then it starts to go all downhill from there. So not to get too depressive, I'm going to tell you that you can still make great progress. But the body does start to, it becomes less and less and less optimal. Things just start to wear down. Things start to go down in regards to our hormones and all that. So it is unfortunate, but when your hormones are in their best ranges ever, we make strength progress between workouts. We make growth between workouts. The speed of recovery, our joint health, our workout energy, our daily energy, all of that is the best it's ever going to be. And that starts to be how we define what it should be. So as we're lifting weights, as we're being active, as we feel good in our hopefully late 20s, early 30s, the rest of our life, everything's relative to that. So when I get into my late 30s, early 40s, if it's like in our mind, we're like, oh man, I just don't have the energy I used to have. We're referring to our, you know, 20s and 30s. Now, for most people, and I don't think there's an exception to this, but I never like making like kind of a like aggressive statements when you don't know everyone on the planet. But for most people, and I would assume everyone, our hormones are going to decline as we age. A physiological response, so I think it's pretty safe to say that. I don't think anybody's going to argue that. Now, there are things we can do to counter that with hormone therapy and whatnot. But even with improved lifestyle factors, and we're going to talk about what those are, you can mitigate the decline. You can even actually create an increase. If you haven't been doing a lot of those lifestyle factors, you can get a bump. And then once those lifestyle factors become normal, then it's going to start to decline again. But there is a natural rate of decline. Now, when that starts to happen, whether it's due to age or if somebody's in a ridiculously highly stressful season of life, those typical training adaptations and recovery aspects start to decline. So I've worked with people, like hundreds and hundreds of people, that are in their 20s or even early 30s where their hormones have tanked and gone to crap because just an enormous amount of stress, really, really poor lifestyle habits, and other kind of conditional things. And when we start to address those, we start to work on that, we can actually improve their hormone health without using hormone therapy, as in like not using exogenous forms of testosterone or other elements like medications. We can make improvements through lifestyle factors, sleep, stress management, nutrition, and supplements, like over-the-counter supplements. Now, as that, in those seasons of life or as the age happens, we start to decline, you may go from, you know, you used to be able to do 4 to 5, you know, hardcore kick butt workouts per week. Now you do 1 or 2 in the beginning of the week and you feel like you got your butt kicked the rest of the week. So we start to feel that way. Now, does this natural declining of our hormone health mean that we cannot achieve great results? Hell no, absolutely not. My mom is actually a great example of this. She started eating healthier and lifting weights when she was 47. We did a first bodybuilding show. Yes, my mother has done a bodybuilding show. She's actually done 3 of them. We did our first one at 50, and she did great. But as we were training for the bodybuilding shows, I think she did one at 50, 51 and 54, or 51, 50, 52 and 54, somewhere in there. So she did 3 of them. She really loved the weight training aspect. She loved getting stronger. And I was like, well, you know, at 54, she was starting to feel like, am I getting too old to do this? The answer is no. But she was worried about that. So I was like, well, if you like lifting weights, let's go into lifting weights as the main focus. Why don't we get into powerlifting? So we got into powerlifting. She's done over 10 competitions. She's actually earned 2 elite totals. So an elite total is a certain standard of strength in powerlifting. It's like becoming a professional athlete, for example. Like it's the getting to the NBA of basketball. Elite total, I think it's less. Last time I looked at it, it's less than 2% of competitive powerlifters ever get an elite total. My mom has 2 of them. So she has 2 of them in 2 different weight classes. That's pretty freaking badass, you know. To achieve something less than 2% have and to have done it twice is pretty awesome. So I'm very, very, very happy for her. And that was all done through her 50s and 60s. I've helped hundreds of clients at 50 plus years old. I've helped dozens of clients in their 40s compete in like aesthetic competitions and significantly more than that in strength competitions in their 40s and 50s. So we've seen people get stronger, build muscle, lose body fat, get whatever they want in their 50s, 60s. I've even worked with people in their 70s and 80s, yes. Now at 80, we're kind of working on getting out of a chair without using your hands. But hell, that's a pretty big accomplishment for some people. So we've seen that you can make progress at any age. Now, the rate of progress is, you know, frustrating at times. It might be a little slower, but it's absolutely still possible. So whether somebody has declining hormonal health due to age, whether they have declining hormonal health due to crazy life stress, That is stuff that we can manage. That is stuff that will not hold you back from making progress. But yes, you do have to actually maybe put some effort into accounting for that. So maybe when you were younger, you didn't have to worry so much about what you ate, but now you do. Maybe when you were younger, you didn't have to worry so much about sleep, but now you do. So there are going to be some elements that we have to start to worry about and account for that if we truly still want to make progress, they do now matter more than they used to. A list of general lifestyle factors would be sleep. We want to work on going to bed at the same time every night. I would encourage everyone to do that. That is very helpful for hormonal health. It's also helpful for stress and just happiness and a whole bunch of good stuff comes from that. Yes, try to go to bed at the same time. Now, I have learned. I used to cheat and stay up late to get work done and do all these things, and man, I did that, paid for that. So that was not good. So I learned this one firsthand for sure. So now what I've learned and doing the research and actually putting it into practice is it's much better to go to bed at the exact same time. But if you need to cut on sleep for something, get up earlier. Now that can be challenging. A lot of people have trouble going to bed when they know they have something to do yet. So I do understand that there are limitations with people and for individuals. But in general, say I normally go to bed at 10 p.m. and I get up at 6 a.m. and I'm like, oh my gosh, like I'm so behind. I'll still try to go to bed at 10 p.m., but I'll get up at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. to get some extra work done. That has been shown in studies to still be a better way of doing it, way of managing sleep if you're going to cut down on sleep. So it has less of a negative impact on hormonal health. However, it's still not optimal. You know, we would love to be able to go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time, and that would be best. But I do encourage clients in these situations to track when they go to bed and try to make a consistent habit of going to bed. Even if you just have to lay in bed and read a book, or, you know, have your phone sitting next to you and just listen to an audiobook or a podcast, but don't be staring at the screen. Don't pick up the phone. Don't hold the phone. We just try to do no screen time, minimal physical exertion. We just want to let the body relax. Just let it calm down. Let everything lower down. Let it come down from the day. So we'll work on going to bed at the same time. Calories, we absolutely need to have sufficient and consistent caloric intake for our hormones to be healthy. A lot of times when people come to me with poor hormonal health, if it's not related to age, it's almost always directly related to nutrition. They're either chronically underfed or chronically overfed, so we want to work on that. The underfed aspect, which is more common, is we make sure that they're eating a caloric amount at about 10% above their BMR or RMR. The BMRs are basal metabolic rate, RMRs resting metabolic rate, same thing. But that would be how many calories your body needs just to be alive. So if you were to lay in bed all day, but you're alive and breathing, there's an amount of calories you need, and that's around 60 to 70% of your total daily usage. So it's actually much higher than what most people think. Just being alive requires 60 to 70% of the calories that you need every day. So that's very important to know that, as that starts to kind of help create a healthier baseline. So for example, say somebody normally eats 1,500 calories and they're like, oh, I have a really low activity day today. I'm just going to be sitting at a computer. I'm going to cut it down. I'm only going to eat 800. No. No. Even if you're super sedentary, you still want to have at least 70-ish percent of your total calorie intake, but I would actually argue for hormonal health, you want to have at least around 80% of what your total daily need would be. So we would use the RMR or the BMR as a baseline, then add 10% to that. And usually that's going to be somewhere where the person is in a healthy range. Now that's actually going to still be in a deficit, so they're going to be losing body fat, but that's at least a minimum, because I've had people come to me eating 500 to 1,000 calories a day, wondering why they can't lose weight, wondering why their hormones are trash, and it's because they're just way too low. So we have to work on getting them up. Now you can find your BMR or RMR. You can do in-body scans, DEXA scans, hydrostatic weighing. You can do bod pods. There's often a lot of things around where people live if you live next to a city. If you have any questions finding any of that kind of stuff, just shoot me a message on our website, www.brutalirongym.com. You can go to the bottom of the homepage. There's a contact form. Just tell me that you're searching for, you want to find your BMR, and I'll help you find wherever that is where you live. Okay. Protein, we have to have a sufficient and consistent amount of protein. That is a huge, plays a huge role in hormonal health. And we know that if somebody's weight training a minimum of 3 times a week, and I would argue even like 2 times a week, you want to have 0.8 grams per pound of body weight. And typically we use a lean body weight, how much you would weigh at say 10 to 15% body fat, not like 0% body fat and not wherever you are. If you're at, you know, say 30% body fat, we don't need to have that much protein. But around a lean desirable weight, you're like, oh, okay, if I weighed this, I'd probably feel pretty comfortable in a, you know, bikini or bathing suit on the beach. And that would be the weight we would use. The next thing we look at is alcohol. We want to avoid all alcohol. There is not an amount of alcohol that doesn't have a negative impact. All alcohol has some negative impact directly on hormones. So if you have less than optimal hormonal health, I certainly would not be touching that. It's like if you have lung cancer and you're smoking. Probably not a great idea. So if you have hormonal health, alcohol is a no. Then we want to look at stress. Whenever I talk about stress, everybody's like, you know, screw you. How, if I could be less stressed, I would be. And it's like, well, you got to work on it. It just doesn't happen. So we want to work on, you know, creating people and work priority lists. I've gone through this with people. Pre-day planning, whether you do it the night before or the morning of, that can help reduce stress if you plan out your day because you know exactly what you should be doing each moment of the day. Daily gratitude journals, brain dumps, meditation, quiet moments, all that stuff. So when I work with people with hormonal issues, we get into that as much as they are willing to let me. Sometimes people will be very dismissive, and I'll tell them everything I've just said so far, and they just want to know what supplements they can take. And I'm like, the supplements aren't going to do jack shit if your sleep is trash, your food is trash, you're still drinking alcohol, and if you have no stress management like methods as a regular routine, the supplements are worthless. You're absolutely throwing money away, and you're avoiding the actual work of what you need to do. So I would really encourage you to not avoid the areas I just talked about. If you have declining hormonal health or situational poor hormonal health, you absolutely want to look at sleep, calories, protein, alcohol, and stress before you consider anything else. Now, what else would you consider? And this is why, please, hopefully, don't just go to the next things I say, which are going to be the over-the-count supplements that can help. So supplements that can help is ashwagandha, DHEA, I don't actually know how to say this word, PANAX, ginseng. I'm going to say PANAX, ginseng, and I could probably be so wrong. A lot of these supplemental things I read in journals about, and then I send people via email or our Google Doc, and I realize how often, how inoften I actually say these things out loud. So these are the moments where I'm like, oh damn, how do you say that? I've looked at this, oh, I don't even know, thousands of times, and now I'm like, holy crap, I have to say that out loud, and I don't think I ever have. L-arginine and ZMA. So those are some things we would look at for supplements. Again, ashwagandha, DHEA, PANAX, ginseng, L-arginine, and ZMA. My wife has a degree in chemistry, so I'm going to ask her how to say that one word, and she's probably going to giggle because it's not even probably close to correct. But how you spell it was PANAX, ginseng. Now, there's a cheap-ish ways to get that stuff. NutriCost is one of the companies I like the most. I'm not sponsored by them. They're going to have no clue that I made this podcast and mentioned their name. However, actually, there are two people who work for that company that actually have expressed listening to the podcast before, so that's pretty cool. But if they hear it, you know, thanks to you, NutriCost, for making good products that are actually reasonably priced. So I use NutriCost for everything except for one of the proteins that I like to have is from Muscle Meds. It's a carnivore beef isolate protein, but I still do use actually a vanilla protein from NutriCost that I mix with orange juice and Greek yogurt to make a protein shake. But NutriCost is great, super cheap. You can find them on Amazon, and that whole list might cost you $20 a month, maybe $30 a month, that if that, and that's probably already overkill if you get all five of those, but it would, you know, why not? That's what we want to talk about when it comes to everything that supports our training. I know that when people ask me training question, they do not want me talking for, let's see here, 24 minutes about nutrition and supplements. But too damn bad, you're going to get it. Because the training stuff that I want to get into now will make very little, if any, difference if you don't have nutritional support and or the supplements to go with that. So that's why I like taking the time to talk about that. So that way, if you are a trainer and someone comes to you and they just ask training questions, you can understand that if their nutrition is not accounted for, your suggestions are going to be heard, applied, and thought wrong. Yes. They will try what you tell them to try, and it will not work because they don't have nutritional support. And then they're going to think that what you told them is wrong. And that's not true. Hopefully, if you told them what we tell you in the podcast. But if they don't have nutritional support, they're not going to get the results they want. They're going to think you're wrong. They're going to go keep asking everybody else. And until they address nutrition and supplements, they're not going to see what they want to see. Now, we get into training. Now, I'm going to go through this. And not everybody might agree with my approach. But I'm going to tell you an approach that has worked hundreds of times. Hundreds of times. I've worked with well over 3,000 people, and not everybody is an aging population. Not everybody has hormonal issues, but oh man, easily hundreds. Easily hundreds. So, I typically do not use percentages when I train my clients. If I do use percentages, I use percentage ranges. So I might say, hey, I want you to be between 80 to 85% today. Your first working set, have it 80%. If it feels good, move up to 80, you know, 2.5. If that feels good, finish the working sets at 85%. But if 82.5 felt like kind of crap and you couldn't quite do great technique, just stay there. Don't increase up to 85%. What I don't like to see are programs that just give a singular percentage for the day. So today we're going to do 5 sets of 2 at 90%. No. I don't like that. And this is my opinion. Everybody can tell me I'm wrong. But it's my opinion and I've seen it work with clients. And the general concept that I use to explain this is our 100% changes. Unless you're working with people where this is the only thing they do all day, every day. And I do work with people who have who are professional athletes, Olympic athletes. I've worked with people who are IFBB pros, who are powerlifting maybe through their personal training and YouTube and you know, social media stuff. They make a good living off of being a powerlifter, so therefore it's kind of like their profession now. I work with people where their life centers around this stuff. Even those people still have inconsistencies to life, let alone people where this isn't their primary financial focus, like their financial income. This isn't like the be-all, end-all of what they do. Then you're definitely going to have even more inconsistencies. And what I mean by this is, if we are basing a program off of a 100%, meaning, you know, the best I can bench, let's say, is 315 pounds. So I tested that last month. I got 315. So now everything I do this next month is based off of 315 pounds. Chances are you can't come in and do that 315 on a whim. You might not be able to come in the next time and hit 315 because maybe you didn't sleep as well. Maybe you didn't eat the right foods. Maybe you have to train at a different time of the day than what you're used to training. Maybe you have more stress at work. Maybe you have more stress at home. There's going to be a lot of things that would factor into us not feeling and being 100% every time we come in the gym. So if I'm asking myself to do something relative to 100%, my 100% changes, therefore I will not be able to do that. So that's why I like percentage windows. Let's say I know what my 100% is, but now I'm going to base that off of understanding, okay, if normally at 100% I would do 85% of work in week one, I'm now going to say 80 to 85. So I will use a range either 5% below and to that number or 2.5% below and to that number, but I like 5%. Gives more people like more actual like number usage. So gives them more weight load options, basically. So I would absolutely use a window range for percentages, if you're going to use percentages. I like to use RPE in cases like this. So RPE is rate of perceived exertion, and that is how challenging something feels. On a scale of 1 to 10 is typically what people use for powerlifting, but they don't use 1 to 5 because you're not doing anything that's less than a 5 in the gym. So 5 is I'm moving and I'm active, but it's not really challenging. 6, I'm moving, I'm active, it's starting to feel a little challenging. 7, yeah, there's a light burn. I might start to get a little bit winded. I can do this, but I can definitely tell I'm doing something. 8 is, holy crap, this is really starting to actually get really challenging, and I'm having to like kind of get myself intensity for this, like get my mind ready for it. This is starting to like really work me. 9 is, holy freaking crap, that was so hard. I don't know if I could do that again. 10 was, I can't believe I survived that. So if we use that RPE scale, rate of perceived exertion, most people should be lifting in the gym around an 8 RPE in most cases. Most people, most scenarios, most, you know, whatever the common stuff is, we want to have around an 8 RPE. That means that every once in a while they're going to drop to 7. Every once in a while they're going to go up to 8. I mean, up to 9. But in general, the proper intensity that we should have is around an 8 RPE. Now, I actually just talked about this in podcast 1967, which was titled Where to Properly Apply Intensity and Strength Training. We talked about people tend to be too intense in the main lifts, not intense enough in the accessories. So we want to normalize that a bit. Make sure the main lifts are around 8 RPE. Make sure the intensities are around 8 RPE. Another way I'll do this is reps in reserve, RIR, is I might tell a client, hey, I want you to do a set of 5 with 2 reps in reserve. The challenge with that is they often don't have a clue of how many reps they can actually do, so they don't know when to stop. They're usually able to understand an RPE sensation and feeling sooner than they can understand RIR. But in certain situations, I'll still do RIR, especially my more advanced clients. They have a great training history. They know exactly what they're doing. So I can use RIR in certain circumstances, and it works out really well. Now, I will tend to use an RPE scale, and I'll use progressive set and rep schemes. I want to give you one example, but I want to preface it by saying this isn't the only example. This isn't the only way of doing it. So an example that I have taught to my training clients, my clients who are trainers, actually over half of my clients are trainers, so I do this a lot. And one of the things we'll do is an RPE progression. So we'll do a 4-month like macro cycle, meaning that month 1 is its own set of exercises, its own parameters. Then month 2, we switch exercises, we switch to new parameters. Then month 3, we do another switch. Then month 4, we're going to work on, at the end of month 4, testing our max. So we're going to take 4 months to work up to a max effort, and then we'll repeat. Month 1, we're going to use a 7 RPE on the main lifts. So I want it to feel like they're doing work, but at no point does technique break down. There's really no, like, oh, crap, you know, I didn't get it. There's definitely no failed reps at a 7 RPE. They're going to feel like I probably could have done 2, maybe even 3 more reps. But we're going to do just a month of 7 RPE. Month 2 is 8 RPE. We're now getting a little more intense. Things are starting to challenge us. Technique might start to vary a little bit. They might have a rep where they kind of do something poor in technique, but they can fix it on the next rep. Month 3 is going to be 9 RPE. And now, so this means we're getting them used to damn near all intense, full max effort lifts. I want to start getting their CNS used to it. I want to start getting their confidence used to it. How does it feel to get under something that feels really freaking heavy and actually has you starting to question whether or not you'll actually be able to do it? Then month 4, we start at a low RPE in the first week, and then each week we ramp up to a 10 RPE in week 4. So that's the RPE progression that I tend to use. It's month 1, 7 RPE on the main lifts. Month 2, 8 RPE. Month 3, 9 RPE. Month 4, by week 4, we do a 10 RPE max test. Doesn't mean it's a 1 rep max. Sometimes I do a 2 rep or even 3 rep max. But it's some type of max effort at a 10 RPE. The sets and reps that I use. This is wildly variable depending on my clients. So the example is, I might have somebody in month one. We might do 5 sets of 5 in week one, then 5 sets of 4 week two, 5 sets of 3 in week three, 5 sets of 2 in week four. The assumption is, if I'm doing sets of 5, then 4, then 3, then 2, each week I'm going to be able to add weight load. If last week I did, say, 225 pounds for 5 reps, and then this week I'm only needing 4 reps, I probably can do at least 230 pounds. You know, if I'm going to drop a rep, I could probably move up 5 pounds. So each week, if we drop a rep, we're going to probably be able to add weight. So this gets their body used to the addition of weight load through the 4-week span. Now, you'll notice 5 weeks, like 5 sets of 5 in week one is 25 reps. And then we go to five sets of 4 reps, I'm sorry, is 20 reps in week two. Then we go 15 reps in week three, then only 10 reps in week four. Our volume, it looks, is going down, and that's actually true. So even though our weight load goes up, our volume goes down. We're not volume driven when we're training for strength. We are weight load driven. We want to get the perception of weight load to continue to increase, the intensity of the weight load to continue to increase. Volume driven programming is more so muscle tissue development, not strength development. Volume driven in strength is when you repeat a cycle. Then you maybe want to see if you can increase volume. But we're not trying to increase volume week by week by week by week by week. That is not the main driver of progress in strength-based training. So we do 5 sets of working sets in month one. And like I said, reps per set is 5, 4, 3, and 2. So 5 reps per set in week one, 4 reps per set in week two, 3 reps per set in week three, 4 reps per set, 2 reps per set in week four. So that's what we do in week in month one. Then in month two, we do 4 working sets instead of 5 working sets. And that's because our RPE is now higher. So we're going to start to challenge the body more intensely. Therefore, we need less total working sets. Month three, we're still keeping the, you know, reps of 5, then 4, then 3, then 2 per week. But we're going to drop now down to just 3 working sets. Because, again, we went up in RPE. We went to a 9 RPE. So since we're more intense in our weight load, we don't need as many working sets to create the same amount of adaptive response. If we were to keep 5 working sets at a 9 RPE, there's no way. You're going to have to reduce weight load so much so each set that it's going to be borderline worthless by the last set. Or they're going to get hurt because that's just way too intense. Way too much volume for too much intensity. So that's what we do is months 1, 2, and 3 is week 1 of each month we do 5 reps. Week 2 of each month we do 4 reps. Week 3 of each month we do 3 reps. And week 4 of each month we do 2 reps. How many working sets is month 1 is 5 working sets. Month 2 is 4 working sets. Month 3 is 3 working sets. And that's because the RPE, the intensity of the weight load, is increasing each month. So therefore, the total amount of working sets decreases. Then in month 4, we'll do the first week is 5 sets of 2 reps at 7 RPE. The second week, I usually do around 3 working sets at 2 reps at 8 RPE. Week 3, we do 2 working sets at 2 reps at 9 RPE. And then week 4, work up to a 1 rep max. Now, that one's super variable. But the idea is the first week, we drop down the intensity because we just really push them the whole way through the third month. We drop down the intensity but go back up in sets. Then we start to ramp back up again to week 4. Now, the idea of this whole approach is over 4 months, by going from a lower RPE to a higher RPE, we're allowing the body to adjust to the demand of training. The body adjusts actually very slowly at first. So you have to kind of coax the body and take care of the body. You have to be really nice to it at the beginning. So that's why at the beginning we have a low RPE. We also want to allow for technique teaching and refinement. When somebody's first starting, their technique is going to be often not great. And we want to have some teaching moments. We want them to have confidence in being able to adjust. So having a lower RPE helps to improve their technique and it helps give us moments of teaching. It then helps build their autopilot. So the consistency of technique starts to develop sooner because the intensity is low enough to allow for that consistency. It also helps to improve confidence. So it's really important to start with a lower intensity because it helps so many components. And then it also gives time for them to adjust lifestyle factors. If they've been eating haphazardly and now all of a sudden we're trying to normalize calories and protein, for example, that just doesn't flip a switch. People are going to need some time for that to happen. And then the body needs time to adapt to the new numbers and start to utilize those new numbers, which can take a couple weeks. So starting with a lower RPE and then ramping the RPE up over months is allowing for all these factors. The technique development, refinement, autopilot setting, a confidence improvement, allowing the lifestyle factors to start to come into play to give better support to the training. Then the total reducing number of sets, we said, over the 4 months is that each week as their technique improves, they're better able to truly use the purest amount of strength that they actually have, which means you get greater CNS hit, like greater CNS fatigue as their technique improves. As somebody's technique improves, overall, their CNS gets hurt worse in training, gets hit more, because you're truly zapping the body of what it truly was capable of. So as their ability to do so increases, the total volume decreases due to the CNS, increasing CNS fatigue. So that's how we mitigate CNS fatigue or over like burnout. Now, this approach is, I'm assuming that it feels very detailed and a little overwhelming. the one thing to realize is it actually gets way worse. So you can actually do, instead of RPE waves, you can use pre-fatiguing waves, which is what I like to do for a lot of my clients, especially my higher level clients, because if I tell them to do, you know, 5 sets of 2 at 7 RPE, they're going to tell me to go screw myself. Then I find out that they just maxed out because they're like, it felt like it was worthless. Like, why am I going to do a 7? Like, I'm going to do a set of 2, like, when I can actually do like 4 or 5 reps. They're going to feel like they're doing nothing. So I'm like, fine, I'm going to pre-fatigue you. So the set of 2 at like a 7 RPE, like, now you're going to be doing a 9 RPE, but it's going to be underloaded to a 7, what the 7 would have been by pre-fatiguing the muscles. So they're going to do what they feel like was max effort. However, they're so fatigued that it isn't max effort weight load. So I'll use pre-fatiguing to modify the intensity of weight load they can use, even if I can't trust them to use RPE scales. So if they go too crazy on everything, then I'm going to use pre-fatigue, and then they can go as crazy as they want, and it ain't going to happen. So I'll actually sabotage the training if I can't trust them to adhere to RPE scales. So I'll use, month 1 is very direct pre-exhaust. I might have them do like chest flies before their bench press. Good luck doing great on chest, like on bench press, right? Month 2 is an indirect pre-fatigue. So maybe I'll have them do like a high burnout set of like push-ups, or maybe some like clapping push-ups, explosive push-ups. So it's not to muscle failure, but it's to an explosive failure. And that is a lesser level of fatigue, but it's still fatigue. Then month 3, we're going to do no pre-fatigue whatsoever. Let them truly start to move some things around that they're truly capable of. Then month 4, we're going to test. So I do a lot of that, and that's actually my preferred method, but that was too complex to teach in a podcast. So pre-fatiguing waves is great because the person gets to go into the gym and feel like they're doing their absolute best every single workout, but I'm controlling what that best actually is to modify and control their CNS, and then it also makes space for us to bring up weaknesses. So it's a really wonderful approach, is using pre-fatigue waves rather than RPE waves. But that takes a very one-on-one approach. So if you're working with multiple athletes or multiple clients and you don't currently have a one-on-one approach to the programming, that's not going to really be a great option because that takes a lot of time to learn, and you do then have to approach each client as an individual. We can also do accessory volume waves, and I'll do that as a way to further modify the intensity of the programming if needed. So maybe month 1, we have a lot of accessories. Month 2, we bring the accessories down and have them be less intense, or and you can do that in various ways. Month 3, we might have very low accessories. Month 4, only queuing accessories at all. And what that does is it helps improve recovery each month. So if I feel that they're under-recovered, I will modify the accessory intensity, and that is a way to have them catch up on recovery if needed. So there are many ways that you can control the intensity and the overall volume of programming to better control stress demand. So in general, what we're looking for is we start at lower weight and lower intensity, and we work on lifestyle factors. So if you have somebody who's in the aging population and or low hormonal health, we want them in the gym, we want them active, we want them doing stuff, but we're not looking to push their current body like to the edge because they don't have a safe edge right now. If they haven't been eating right, calories and protein, they haven't been sleeping well, they haven't been managing stress well, if we don't have the supplements in place, that edge is a really fine line. It's a razor's edge. So if you try to push them to the edge, you can get caught real quick. And all of a sudden they get an annoyance or an injury. And now, good luck, you know, you lose the next couple months of training trying to modify and correct for that. The next thing we look at for is in general concepts, we want to increase weight and intensity as their training performance indicates it's able to do so. So the first month, maybe you're trying to be cool and everything, be calm with everything. And the last week, you're like, hey, let's do 5 sets of 2 at a 7 RPE. And they blow through all 5 sets. And they're like, dude, like I'm smoking this. It looks like I could damn near double this weight. Well, then in the next month, when we move up to an 8 RPE, maybe our weight load expectation increases more. So maybe I thought we were only going to make a 5 or 10 pound jump. Maybe we can make a 15 or 20 pound jump now. So we modify as the intensity in the as their performance shows, but I don't want to assume performance ahead of it. So I wouldn't want to say, oh, you know, by week four and month two, they should be able to add 25 pounds. No, wait until you're there to see if they're actually able to do that. So you want to see what they're doing each week and then say, okay, they did this well. They did it well, but it looked kind of on edge. Let's only go up 5 pounds. Or they destroyed that. We probably could go up 20, but let's be safe and let's just go up 10. If they crush that next week, then let's go up the other 10, right? So you can see how they're performing and then adjust the intensity at that time. But I wouldn't like pre-assume there's going to be certain progressions. I would see how they perform each week. And then based on that, you would make increases. Now, especially an example of the person who sent in this request, they're very intelligent with training. They absolutely know what they're doing. They've seen everything. So if they look at them and they're like, hey, you know, they did really well, they can make a 10-pound jump next week, they're going to be really good at guessing that. So their assumptions are going to be very good at guessing weight increases. The next thing we want to look at is, in general, we don't want to fail reps. I really would not recommend failing reps on a regular basis at all. You know, I try to have my clients really never fail reps in most cases. In some cases, I will be okay with them failing reps if we're really trying to push an adaptive response and we know it's safe. So for example, if I have a 135-pound athlete, we'll say 135 to 155-pound athlete, female athlete, and their bench press right now is like 125, 130. I might have them go ahead and grind out some failed reps. I might have them push more often to failure than somebody else. But if you're benching 2 times your body weight, hell no, I ain't going to have you go to failure because something might tear. You know, but if somebody's benching less than their body weight, they're very unlikely to tear anything. So that's something where in that case, in that scenario, we might push closer to failure more often. But in general, I try not to have people fail reps too often. What is too often? I guess I should be answering that. Really, maybe one or two failed reps per 3 or 4 months. That's the most. In some cases, they will be more often than that. But in a general recommendation is 1 to 2 failed reps, 1 or 2 failed attempts every 3 or 4 months is probably good enough. The reason why is if you fail more often than that, you jack up their confidence. You also, they tend to break good technique during that failed rep. So then you're not setting that autopilot for good technique consistency. When they do, then go back to up to a one rep max. So if you see that somebody like just abandons good technique when they try max, that's because they're abandoning good technique too often in training. You need to control their technique more often in training and only reinforce the right pathway at all times. Then the last thing is, if you don't see any progress in a main lift, I would check their lifestyle factors, check their food, sleep, stress, all those things. I would then maybe restart progressions. Even if you're in week three and something's gone to trash, be like, you know what, let's next week, let's just start over. Let's start back at some lighter weights, higher reps, like higher sets, get your confidence back in, then let's progress from there. And then I would also look at their accessories. We may have added an accessory that's too aggressive. So I'll see this sometimes when people add in weighted dips. And they're like, oh, my bench kind of went to crap in week three. I'm like, yeah, because you're doing a max effort, like you're doing max effort, really demanding bench pressing. And then all of a sudden you go right to a weighted dip, which is this damn near the same thing. Like there's very, it's a ridiculously heavy aggressive compound movement after a ridiculously heavy aggressive compound movement. So we might be, our accessories might be getting too demanding and we need to pull those back. So that's what I would look for if they're not making progress that you expect, is check their lifestyle factors, restart progressions on the main lifts to rebuild confidence, and then check, double check their accessories. One of the accessories might be too aggressive. So what's interesting is as we discuss this, as we discuss the concepts that are involved with trying to get somebody to make progressive overload in aging population or people with like less than optimal hormonal health, it's no different than anybody else that I work with. Everyone I work with, the way I work with clients is on an individual basis. I don't use any pre-written programming. There's no programming that is copy and pasted from person to person. So what I mean by that is I'm not going to have everyone I work with say, you know, week one, we're going to do five sets of five, 80 to 85%, everyone. No, not doing that, because when you work with multitude of people, you start to realize that not everybody responds the same way to training. So therefore, I am not going to fit all of my individuals to a training program when I have the knowledge to personalize their actual training program. So rather than fitting them into a program, I'm gonna fit the program to them. Now, I have the availability to do that. I have the preference to do that. That's why I only work with a certain amount of people, because well, I've gotten overextended before, and the amount of personalization actually was never the problem. It was the communication. I just couldn't communicate with people often enough for what they wanted and what I wanted. So that became an issue. So I had to cut down on the number of people I worked with. So that's kind of my always ongoing lesson, is to stop saying yes or find other ways to say yes. That's a better way of saying it. Is that's why I offer various services now. Is it, like the services on the website might feel actually confusing because there's so many, but at the same time is I had a hard time. I can't say no to people whenever they reach out to me and they want help, because that's the whole freaking reason why I'm on this planet. And that's why I believe God gave me the knowledge that he did give me, is to help people. So saying no doesn't honor God's gift to me. It doesn't honor what I think my purpose is. And it sure as hell doesn't help that person. So I want to say yes, but I want to say yes in a way that best matches their individual needs, which is why there are various services on the website. Some people want really in-depth. They can afford really in-depth, high-frequency communication. Some people would love that. They just can't afford it. And for me to give it at a lower cost, then all of a sudden I'm not communicating with enough people and I can't help enough people. So I give a different type of service that then can give them the help that they need for the next step, but at a price that they can afford and at a communication rate that still allows me to help the most amount of people. But when I'm thinking of how do I program people for a progressive overload, it's the same for everyone. It's just, when somebody has better hormonal health, you would just expect things to move a little faster. And when it doesn't, you then still double check the same things. We still look at lifestyle factors. We still consider, you know, are the main lifts progressing too quickly? Did we add an accessory that's too demanding? It's the same damn stuff. It's just things tend to progress faster for people when they have better hormonal health than when they don't. So the 61-year-old client, I don't know if I would approach it any differently than I would with the younger clients. I would just not push them to technique failure. I would make them be much crisper in their technique. And in a sense, you're actually controlling their RPE. So make them train at a lower RPE than your regular lifters, but they should still be able to make progress. The reason why we want to lower RPE is we just don't want to burn out their CNS. We don't want them to get hurt. We want to give their body time to adapt between training. So rather than burying them in a major hole each week, we bury them in a less of a hole. And their body has a chance to actually recover that. So what you would notice is if your intensity was too much, they would stop being able to make progress within, say, an 8 to 12 week span. Maybe sooner, maybe later, but in general, 8 to 12 weeks, all of a sudden, they used to be coming in and being able to add 10 pounds every week or add 2 or 3 reps every week, and now all of a sudden they're getting nothing or they're actually falling behind. That means our intensity has been too high, and we need to bring that down, and RPE is a great way to adjust for that. So keep everything they do super clean, super crisp. Don't let their butt come off on bench. Make sure the squat's always a parallel. It's not turning into a good morning. Make sure the deadlift has good, clean technique. They're not hitching. No hitches allowed on deadlift. No butt up on bench press. No bouncing the bar off their chest in bench press. Make everything super clean. And that is going to control the intensity enough that's probably going to allow them for appropriate recovery and appropriate progression in training. Okay, very, very, very long podcast, but I hope it was helpful. I hope that when people check in for this type of topic, you like the depth of the information that's covered, so that way you get the big picture, but also the small picture of information that you'd like. If you have any follow-up questions, if you like this kind of podcast, let me know. This is typically a longer podcast than what I would usually do, but if people find this helpful, it's great for me to know that. I usually cut my podcast shorter because I just don't think people want to listen for that long. So if you like longer podcasts, if you like the more detail, please let me know so that way I can always be modifying the podcast to exactly what you want. Thank you to those who reach out and send responses and feedback. I love it, and I greatly, greatly appreciate it. So thank you. And then if you like the podcast, please share the podcast. The more people we share it with, whether that's word of mouth or on social media, the more people the podcast can help. And that's the main goal. If you like the podcast, you can consider donating to support the podcast financially. You can do that actually on our website to help cover our hosting costs and all the other stuff that's involved. And if you like the information in the podcast, you can always find more from us on our social media channels. You can find us and follow us on Instagram and YouTube under the name Brutal Iron Gym. As always, I hope this was helpful, and thank you for listening.